are listening to A Scary State, and this week we're covering Rhode Island. So, Nora.
Yes, Lauren.
Let's get scary.
So, before we start talking about Rhode Island, we have a few things to update you guys on. First off, Lauren is going to talk about some updates in a case that she covered.
So, some true crime updates we have for you guys. So, a couple episodes ago, or weeks ago maybe, I said how Anissa Weyer from the Slender Man stabbing case, one of the girls, was going to be released from prison soon or from her mental health facility soon. Mm-hmm. She was just released like last week, so very, very recently, which is very interesting.
Yes.
I don't think she should have been released personally, but that's just me. So I guess we'll just have to kind of see where she goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, the world is a tiny bit less safe with that girl out there on the streets.
I mean, I hope she got the help she needed. So I hope that, you know, she's where she needs to be. But yeah, it's still kind of scary.
Very, very quick punishment
for
her.
Yes.
Very quick. So now that we've updated that, I'm sure everyone knows that Gabby Petito, that whole story has been all over the news. Honestly, we haven't even, I don't even think we've recorded since all of that happened.
We haven't.
It was so quick.
We got really ahead of things and we were really on top of things. We recorded ahead of time. But then, yeah, now we're recording after all this stuff has been happening.
Yeah. So I'm sure, you know, everyone's heard of it, heard what's going on. If you haven't, I would highly suggest listening to Crime Junkie. They did like a off-schedule coverage of it. Even though I have my qualms with Crime Junkie because I think they're super scripted sometimes, they did, or I guess Ashley did such a good job covering exactly what happened, the timeline. And she actually released that episode like literally 3 hours before Gabby's body was found.
Oh, that gave me chills.
It gave me chills listening to it because she said at the end of it, she was like, I bet you in the next few hours something big is going to happen because that's how this case is.
Oh.
And then literally 3-4 hours later, they found Gabby's body. So definitely thinking about that, I've been very invested in that case. And Brian Landry is still out on the loose. So he's been missing since last Tuesday, which is absolutely insane.
Yeah.
We'll update you guys on that case since it's been such a headliner, but also asking everyone to take that same energy and recognize some of the cases that we've done in the past, especially about Indigenous women and how they're missing and have gotten almost no coverage on it.
And missing in the same area too.
Exactly. What happened to Gabby is extremely horrible and tragic. And I just want to make sure that, you know, we can at least acknowledge that that's happening to other people too, to other women who didn't get the same coverage. So,
and we have a platform where we can actually, you know, kind of discuss it, which
is
what we want to do.
Yep. Listen to our Alaska episode.
Oh, that's yes. One. Nora covered a really good one there.
So, anyways, now getting into Rhode Island.
Well, on a happy
note. Oh my gosh,
first,
yeah.
So we just recently got back from my bachelorette trip, which was so much fun. We went to Charleston, South Carolina. And as everyone who knows me knows, I love ghosts. So we went on a ghost tour of the downtown area. It was so cool. I took so many pictures. I've been looking through them. And so, okay. We went to a graveyard, and it's one graveyard where people with contagious, like, diseases, when they died, that's where they were buried. And so I was taking pictures, and in my picture, there's an orb, but it was there when I was, like, taking the picture, I think from a reflection of a light or something.
Yeah.
But there were other places where there were orbs that I don't remember seeing them in the camera. So I'll have to, we'll try to post those on Facebook because that's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I did think it was cool that our tour guide like showed us pictures of.
Oh, that other people
things.
Have taken.
Yeah, that other people. Like he never personally had someone see anything crazy, but he, I guess, got other tour guides who had people. They sent him pictures. So he was able to share them. So that was really cool.
Yeah, so it was a really fun.
Yeah,
it was really fun.
I agree.
But yeah, it was overall just such a fun weekend.
It was. I mean, I'm still kind of recovering.
I have not caught up on my sleep at
Same.
All. So I'm like at work struggling. It's oh man, I've had so much coffee today and it has not helped at all.
Yeah, my boss when I got back, he was like, "How was your trip?" And I was like, "Chaos."
But the best kind of
chaos. I was like, it was really good. It was just we didn't sleep at all. But
oh, yeah.
Like it was fun.
It was so
fun. Yeah.
All right. So now we'll dive on into Rhode Island.
All right. So Rhode Island, nicknamed the Ocean State, joined the Union on May 4th, 1776 and became the 13th state. Rhode Island got its name from the Dutch explorer Adrian Block. He named it Rote Eiland, which means Red Island, because the shores of the state were lined red due to clay. Some weird laws in Rhode Island. In Providence, it is illegal for a store to sell the same person both toothpaste and toothbrush on Sunday. I wonder if it's like,
I don't
something
know.
About like, I don't know.
About
weird.
What, Nora?
I don't know. You know, it's God's day.
The look you're giving me.
It is illegal to bite off another person's leg.
Good.
Very good.
Good.
It is an offense to throw pickle juice at a trolley. That had to happen at some point.
I know. These laws.
I know. You can be imprisoned for 1 to 7 years if you challenge someone to a duel or accept that challenge, even if the duel never actually happens.
Ooh.
I guess maybe that's like kind of gambling.
I don't know.
I don't know.
It was like duels, like horse duels and lance or whatever.
Rhode Island is so small, it only has 5 counties.
Jeez.
If you look at Rhode Island on a map, it's so tiny.
It's so, yeah.
I know, it's so cute and little. The Old Brook Farm, located in Harrisville, actually inspired the movie The Conjuring after the Perrin family who lived there was plagued by a series of terrifying and horrible events.
Things that we might be getting to today.
Oh, is that so?
Mm-hmm.
The ghost of Edgar Allan Poe is said to haunt the Providence Anthanum. I didn't look up that word before, sorry. And Phenelm.
Athenium?
Okay, there we go.
Athenium. I don't know if that's right.
That sounds about right. The grave of Mercy Brown, who was believed to be a vampire during the New England Vampire Panic, is located in Exeter.
I literally didn't know either of those two things when I was writing these notes.
That's crazy. Freddy Krueger is believed to have been inspired by the urban legend of Fingernails Freddy, a violent murderer who lived in the woods and had very long nails.
Ew.
I know. That like gives me goosebumps.
Like that.
I don't like that. This story dates back to the 19th century. Rhode Island has one identified serial killer, which, wow, that's more than I thought Rhode Island would have.
Oh, little Rhode Island.
I know.
All right, today I'm covering The Conjuring and the Perrin family. And so I looked up their name, I tried to find how to pronounce their last name, and again, I found 3 different ways to pronounce it, so I'm just going to say Perrin.
Mm-hmm.
And just to preface, this case was slightly difficult to arrange chronologically. It was hard to find any timelines online and hard to figure out how to organize the events. So if it feels like I'm jumping around a little bit time-wise, that's why.
Okay.
And because everything would be like comparing it to the movie to actually what happened. So it was just, you know, trying to figure out what was the movie, what was real life, trying to figure out what timeline it went in. So.
Well, I feel like most people are pretty familiar with it anyways.
Yeah.
So
the famous movie The Conjuring was released in July of 2013 and grossed $319 million, while its budget was only $20 million. So it made a lot of money. In the film, the Perrin family is tormented by increasingly disturbing events that all occur in their farmhouse in Rhode Island in the 70s. While the film's description isn't too far off from what actually happened in Harrisville, Rhode Island. In December of 1970, Roger and Carolyn Perrin moved their family of 7 into a 14-room farmhouse in Rhode Island, which was known as the Old Arnold Estate. Also, what we talked about at the beginning, it had a couple different names. This farmhouse had been built in 1736 and sat on 20 acres of land. The parents had 5 daughters, Andrea, Nancy, Christine, Cindy, and April, in that order.
Imagine having 5 daughters.
No. I don't even want to. But if I have to, I will love them. But I don't want to.
5, though.
I know. Just think of all the toilet paper you would go through.
Yeah, and all the fights.
Oh, God. I can't. That was the one thing about having a brother. We never fought over clothing.
Oh.
Except sweatpants.
Oh, my gosh. I have 2 sisters, and we drove my dad crazy fighting over clothes. Even our dog was a girl. My poor dad. Sorry. I had to add that.
When my brother went off to the military, I still lived at home for a little bit. So it was me, my mom, and our 2 girl dogs.
Oh.
I was like, oh, dad.
Oh, poor guy.
So before the family even moved into the house, Cindy said that she had loved the house. She couldn't wait to live there and described it as, quote, a piece of heaven inside hell. not, I don't know where the hell came from. I guess maybe Rhode Island. I'm not sure.
I guess.
Nancy, the second oldest daughter, remembers that as they were moving in, literally the day they were moving in, she noticed a man standing in the house while they were bringing in boxes. She thought he was just a nice man, maybe a family member who's going to help him move in. Well, all of a sudden, right before her eyes, he disappeared. Even seeing that, though, they said it never occurred to them that they may be moving into a haunted house. Mm-hmm. So you just have a man disappear in front of you, but it's just a fine house. At the beginning of their time in this house, the parents started to realize that their new house already had a notorious reputation around the area. It is said that their neighbors had told them, quote, "For the sake of your family, leave the lights on at night." The parents never received the reason behind why they were given this advice, though. But later it turned
out. I would have been like, what? Why are you telling me that?
Yeah, right? Like, Roy would love that. He's afraid of the dark. Oh. So anytime lights are on, he's like, heck yeah. Well, later they realized that the house had been a site of many different acts of violence, ranging from suicides, rapes, murders, and drownings. The girls described that the inside of the house had a very heavy feeling. The moment you stepped inside, you would feel an overwhelming sadness. Oh. Previous owners of the house never stayed long either, and at times the house remained vacant. There was a story, they said, of this one guy. He was working in the house, or he owned it or something. I didn't write it down, obviously. Mm-hmm. And he ran out of the house, leaving all of his tools behind. Like, just left them, left, never came back for any of his stuff. So this is the kind of house that they're moving into. So immediately when they moved in, things began happening around the house. And it was just little things at first. Carolyn, the mother, would notice that her broom would go missing, or it would be seen to move from place to place around the house, never being where she left it the time before. She would also hear something scratching against the kettle that she kept in the kitchen, even when no one was in that room. Other strange noises would be heard around the house, but it was easy to explain away as just new house noises. But then she would start to notice small piles of dirt in the middle of the kitchen floor right after she had slept. This occurred so much that this spirit got the nickname of the sweeping ghost. The sound of a broom shuffling would be heard. When someone would go to investigate the sound, the broom would be leaning against a wall with a small pile of dirt next to it. But it's like, how much dirt is in this house if you keep having to sweep dirt? The five girls also started noticing things and spirits around the house, but they described them as being friendly, benevolent, and nonviolent. But slowly, these little harmless acts of the spirits began to take a toll. Cindy talked about how she would be playing with her toys upstairs. She would set them down real quick to run downstairs to grab something. By the time she came back upstairs, all of her toys would be moved around. Some would even be missing. The sisters began blaming each other for the toys that were being moved and hidden, obviously.
I believe that. Yeah.
Yep. Suspicions and accusations began to circle in the girls' minds. The sisters began arguing and actually fighting with each other. The fight started to get so bad that their mother had to pull them off of each other more than once.
Oh.
But for all they knew, the spirits were still pretty nice spirits. The five girls one day had decided to sit down and talk about their golden rule. Their golden rule was that they would share their toys with each other so that there was none of this accusation, none of the stealing. They would just share their toys.
That's good.
Yeah. Cindy, the second youngest, took this to heart and started sharing her toys with the kids' spirits that she was seeing in her room. One of the kids she played with was a little boy named Oliver. There was also a little boy named Manny who they would play with. Just chilling in their room with these random ghost kids. The girls actually started to view these spirits as playmates and sometimes even as babysitters. They were enjoying the company that they were having with these spirits. Cindy was quoted once as saying, quote, "When we first moved into the house, for the first 2 months, there was a woman that came and kissed me every night on the forehead that I thought was my mother."
Oh, that's so creepy.
Her sister Andrea said, "Mom smelled like ivory soap and this spirit smelled like flowers and fruit." So it certainly was not their mother kissing them on the head. The spirit soon got the name of Miss Arnold, maybe for the Arnold estate. But it was found that Miss Arnold did live in the house in the 18th century. She had been the matriarch and lived to be 93 years old. Wow. So it seems like she's just kind of taking care of them, tucking them in for bed for months. But the sad thing is she ended up dying when she hung herself in the barn on the property.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
At 93?
I guess. That's what it said. And I was like, I don't know how that happened, but...
Oh my gosh.
The girls were experiencing friendly spirits for the most part, but the parents weren't so lucky. The parents felt that something was amiss in the house and began experiencing something a bit more sinister. Roger, the father, would open the front door and would be assaulted by an overwhelmingly putrid smell. It happened so often that he would open the front door and yell about the smell. The girls recalled that when this happened, a strong sadness would wash over the house. Roger would also feel a, quote, "cold, stinking presence behind him in the dirt-floored cellar." The family even made an effort to stay away from the cellar whenever possible. But naturally, all of the heating equipment was located in the basement, and naturally, it would always fail. This meant that Roger had to often venture down into the basement to fix it by himself with the spirit he didn't want to go near. And it was very clear that the spirit disliked Carolyn the most. Carolyn was the mother. Mm-hmm. Carolyn said that the spirit would hide things around the house in an attempt to make her feel as if she was going insane. The spirit would pinch and slap her and throw objects at her head. The spirit would hurt her, scream threats, and even show herself to Carolyn to scare her even more. She recalled that shortly after the family moved into the farmhouse, she would regularly be visited at night by a woman in gray whose head was hanging by her side. The look of how someone would be if they had. Yep. So this woman apparently told Carolyn to leave or else she would be driven out instead by doom and gloom. She said, quote, "We'll drive ye out with fiery broom. We'll drive ye mad with death and gloom." And soon that sinister spirit started to interact with the girls and began replacing all of the benevolent happy ones. One day, Cindy had ended up talking to Andrea about what she had been experiencing. A disembodied voice had been telling her that there were 7 bodies buried in the walls of the house. So remember how I mentioned that people had died in the house earlier?
Yeah.
Well, Carolyn had done some research and had learned that a large number of people had, in fact, died in the house and on the property, both people who lived there and people who had just been passing through. So there could be something.
Something.
Carolyn had also discovered that the same family had lived in this house for 8 generations, and many of them had died under mysterious or even horrible circumstances. Several of the children in the family had drowned in a nearby lake, one child was murdered, and a few even hanged themselves in the attic. Cindy said during an interview that she would see the manifestations of a father, son, and their dog at the top of the stairs often, and it was commonly known that the father and son had also died on the property.
Oh, man.
I know. Soon, the family began to be awakened every morning at 5:15 a.m., and they would be awoken to the smell of rotting flesh.
Ugh. Which is a very distinct, horrible smell, like,
gross. Ugh. That wouldn't matter for me because I'm already up by 5:15 a.m. The family's beds would rise off of the floor, sometimes so violently it would throw them to the floor. Cindy said that she had an experience where her bed lifted off the floor. She was screaming and screaming and trying to get her mom's attention. When she finally got out of the room and made it downstairs, she found that no one had heard her. She said you could be screaming upstairs and the house would bubble it so no one would be able to hear you scream. I hate that. The family also reported that spirits and entities would pull their hair and limbs at night. Andrea said that a malevolent male spirit had been torturing the girls, but she had never provided any details about this event. All she said about the events, even years later, was, quote, "Let's just say there was a very bad male spirit in the house with 5 little girls." I hate that.
I hate that too.
So at some point, the parents ended up calling the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine. So let me give you a little background about Ed and Lorraine Warren. So Edward Warren Miney was born in 1926, and Lorraine Rita Warren was born in 1927. So Ed Warren obviously took his middle name, not his last name.
Right.
They were most famous for their reputation as paranormal investigators. Ed Warren was a self-taught and self-proclaimed demonologist, and Lorraine Warren claimed to be a clairvoyant and a medium. In 1952, the two founded the New England Society of Psychic Research, which is actually the oldest ghost hunting group in New England. The two worked together to investigate different paranormal happenings and have claimed to have investigated over 10,000 cases. According to many sources, to include the Warrens, the official website of the New England Society of Psychic Research, and Viviglam magazine, the Warrens and their research society use many different individuals for their investigations, to include medical doctors, nurses, police officers, researchers, college students, and members of the clergy. So they would bring these people with them to their different investigations to kind of have, I guess, all different walks of life there. Mm-hmm. Some notable cases are obviously the Conjuring case, as well as the Amityville haunting, which took place in New York. Not surprisingly, many of their investigations and cases had been adapted and have inspired many different films, documentaries, and TV shows. Another very notable character in the Warrens' occult world is Annabelle.
Annabelle.
So a brief story about her is that in 1968, 2 college roommates claimed that a spirit of a little girl named Annabelle Higgins had possessed their Raggedy Ann doll. After much investigations, the Warrens told the roommates that the doll had been manipulated by an inhuman presence. The doll is now on display in the Warrens Occult Museum in Monroe, Connecticut, in a glass box with a sign that says, "Positively do not open." The museum closed in 2019 and has remained closed since. So I mention Annabelle because she has become a large part of the Conjuring universe that took off once the first film of this was released. But as with anyone, the Warrens faced their share of backlash. Their stories have been said to be fake, invented for popularity, and altogether just not real. Apparently, they were also really problematic, like morals wise, but I won't get into that too much.
Okay.
At all, actually. Ed Warren ended up passing away in 2006 at the age of 79, and Lorraine Warren passed away recently in 2019 at the age of 92.
Jeez.
Yeah. So I just wanted to give a little background so you can kind of see where they're coming into this story at.
Yeah.
So the movie shows that the parents called the Warrens and asked for their help, but in actuality, the parents had a neighbor named Barbara. Barbara was aware of the experiences that the family was facing and the events occurring at the farmhouse. Barbara, being a true friend, traveled to Putnam, Connecticut, because she knew of the Warrens and knew that they did investigations in that area. Barbara informed the Warrens about what was happening in the parents' home in Harrisville, Rhode Island, and they immediately knew they wanted to come check it out and investigate. The Warrens and the parents soon came to believe that the spirit that was tormenting the family was the ghost of Bathsheba Thayer, or Bathsheba Sherman. So Thayer was born in 1812 and married a man named Judson Sherman in 1844. Thayer had lived in the house in the 19th century and during that time had four children, three of whom died while living in this house.
Oh.
Thayer ended up receiving a bad reputation in the area at the time as she was accused of stabbing her infant in the neck with a knitting needle in order to sacrifice the baby to Satan.
What?
Uh-huh. But also, this is the time when, like, you sneeze wrong and you're a witch, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing came out of this claim, though, because there wasn't enough evidence to be held up in court. She was also accused of being involved in the death of a neighborhood child, but no trial ever took place for this claim either. Local lore stated that Thayer, who then became Sherman, was a witch and had made a pact with the devil. She would be granted youthful beauty, but as payment, her body would be turned into stone when she died. Well, she lived for many, many years and finally passed away on May 24th, 1885. But her cause of death was a mystery and very odd to the coroner. Mm-hmm. It seemed her cause of death was some rare form of paralysis. He said that her body had somehow solidified, seemingly turning to stone.
Ooh.
Bathsheba is buried in downtown Harrisville in a Baptist cemetery. It is also believed that in death, she was condemned to haunt and torture people out of jealousy for beauty that would never again be hers. Hmm. So after her presence, Andrea, the oldest daughter, said, quote, whoever the spirit was, she perceived herself to be mistress of the house, and she represented the competition my mother posed for that position. Kind of showing you why from the very beginning Carolyn was getting kind of the brunt of all of this.
Yeah.
Andrea also believed that Bathsheba wanted Roger, her father, but Carolyn was in the way, and that the witch would do whatever she could to get to Roger.
What? That's so creepy.
So the Warrens and Perrins believed that they were being haunted predominantly by the spirit of this woman, and that is who was tormenting and terrorizing them. The hauntings and investigations by the Warrens went on for 10 years at the Perrins' home. During these years, they reported being poked, pinched, and prodded, but with most of the harmful hauntings being focused on Carolyn. At some point during the investigations, Carolyn received a mysterious stab wound in her leg. Lorraine Warren stated that it looked similar to the one wound that the baby would have received and that Bathsheba had taken her knitting needles to the grave with her and was using them for her hauntings. Because she had like a mark on the back of her leg and it looked like a knitting needle. Yeah. Carolyn constantly felt tormented, both physically and emotionally, by Bathsheba and stated that she felt as if the spirit were possessing her. She always felt drained. But Roger, the husband, only experienced the sweet side of this spirit, never the tormenting side. For the longest time, he didn't even believe that anything was happening at their house. He didn't believe in the hauntings at all. But soon, the spirit began touching Roger inappropriately. So Roger finally came around and started to believe that something was off with the house, and he expressed that he wasn't happy about the Warrens coming in. He didn't want to bring anyone else into the situation that they were experiencing. Another thing that happened in the movie that differed from the actual events happened during the game of hide and clap. So how this game is played is that one person who is it will be blindfolded while everyone else goes to hide. The person who is it will then walk around and clap, and everyone hiding has to clap back until someone's found. So in the movie, the mother, Carolyn, is blindfolded. As she is slowly moving around clapping, Bathsheba would scare and taunt her by clapping directly in her face. So that's the movie. But what happened in real life is much different. About 6 months after the family moved in, the girls decided to play the hide and clap game. Cindy was one of the hiders, and she ran outside and decided to hide in the woodshed because they would play outside because the weather was beautiful. Mm-hmm. To make sure she was extra...
And there were no iPads.
Yeah, there were no iPads. To make sure she was extra hidden, she climbed into a wood box that was in the shed. The box simply had a wooden panel that covered it, so no latch, no key, no lock, nothing. Mm-hmm. Literally just a wooden panel. After waiting for a while and never being found, Cindy decided to go back inside and find everyone, tell them, you know, she won, they couldn't find her. Mm-hmm. Well, when she tried to push the panel off of the box, it wouldn't move at all. For 20 minutes, Cindy pushed and yelled and screamed and cried, but was unable to move the lid. Thankfully, her sister Nancy came into the woodshed and heard Cindy screaming. With literally no effort at all, Nancy was able to move the panel off of the box. Facts about the Warrens' help differ from the movie. In the movie, the Warrens successfully cleansed and exorcised the house, Bathsheba was sent back to hell, all was good. Well, in real life, the parents claimed that the Warrens actually made the activity in the house much, much worse. Also, during the years that the Warrens worked with the Perrins, it is said that Lorraine conducted a seance in order to make contact with Bathsheba. The seance took place in the basement, the same place where Roger would feel that cold presence, but it didn't go quite as planned. At one point, it was believed that Carolyn got possessed. She began speaking in tongues and rising off the ground while still being in her chair. Andrea said she had secretly witnessed the seance and said she felt she was going to pass out during it. She said, quote, "My mother began to speak a language not of this world and a voice not her own. Her chair levitated and she was thrown across the room." Lorraine never publicly spoke out about what happened down in the basement, but it is reported that she was clearly disturbed about something she had seen or something that had happened down there. Many years later, she kept saying that it was one of the most terrifying cases she's ever been a part of. So if you've seen the movie, you probably remember a scene similar to this one. But in the movie, the Warrens actually performed an exorcism. So they didn't actually perform it. They just did that for the movie.
Yeah.
Lorraine Warren dispelled that scene, though, and said that it was a seance, as only a Catholic priest can actually perform an exorcism. Because Lorraine and Ed were very, very religious.
Oh.
So they also said
that's
that
crazy if they had bad morals.
Yeah.
I know you don't get into it, but that's interesting. You know?
Podcast I really like, and That's Why We Drink, they did a great episode on Ed and Lorraine Warren where they really went into their background, and you're like, oh, problematic.
Yeah.
But yeah, they were very, very religious, and I read somewhere that Lorraine was saying, you know, our religion is what protects us. Because we are so religious, we are, like, we have God's protection. And she was saying that the Perrins, the reason they were getting all of this stuff was because they weren't religious enough, which I thought was interesting.
That is interesting.
Following
victim blaming going on.
Yeah, right? Following the seance, it is said that Roger kicked out the Warrens. He feared for his wife's mental stability if they stayed. Unfortunately, the parents were unable to move out for all of those years due to financial instability. The housing market had crashed, the economy had tanked, and the family had already poured all of their money into the house. But finally, in 1980, so 10 years after they moved in, Carolyn and Roger were able to sell their house and move to Georgia. Well, many years later, when The Conjuring was set to be filmed, the Perrin family was invited to the set. So they lived many years in Georgia. They're fine. Now this is like close to 2013 when the movie was released. So what, some 30-something years later?
Right.
So at first, the whole family was planning to come back to the set. But just before it was about to happen, Carolyn backed out and didn't attend. The rest of the family attended, and during their visit, a rogue gust of wind swept through the building. It came out of nowhere and knocked down cameras, lights, and even people. The family assumed that the wind was part of the Bathsheba curse that they believed had followed them. Like I said, Carolyn hadn't been at the set that day, but around the same time that the wind blew through the set, Carolyn, who was elsewhere, had fallen and broken her hip. Yep.
Oh, I got goosebumps.
I know. And so this is the story I read about that. So she falls, she ends up in the hospital. They tried to call the family, but the family didn't answer because they were doing the interview.
Oh, God, that scared me.
So she called him during the interview, but they couldn't answer because they didn't have their phones. So when they were able to get to the hospital, she had been in a drug-induced state because she, you know, had just gotten surgery. Mm-hmm. She woke up really quickly, said that Bathsheba didn't want to be exposed, and fell back asleep. So that it was the curse, and that she was talking about the movie that was in production that Bathsheba didn't want, you know. I feel like I'm saying her name a lot and it's kind of scaring me.
Bathsheba.
Others believe this and claim that the spirit wasn't actually attached to the house at all. The spirit was attached to the people. So it was willing to leave the farmhouse, but not willing to leave the family. So it attached itself.
Why would it not be attached to the house?
I don't know. That's just one theory people have.
Oh.
But there could be truth in this. In 1987, a woman named Nancy Sutcliffe purchased the house after the Perrins. She stated that the house is absolutely not haunted. Benevolent spirits, no malevolent spirits, nothing. But another source I read said that this lady's name is Nora Sutcliffe.
Great name.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Norma.
Oh, Norma.
And her and her husband Gary purchased the home in 1983, and that it is indeed paranormally active. So the front door will bang. It will sound like people are talking in the other room when no one else is in the room. Footsteps have been heard. Gary had an odd experience where he was sitting in his office chair when all of a sudden it began to vibrate. They have experienced a blue light flying across the bedroom, fog floating through different rooms throughout their house, and intense vibrations inside the walls that literally shake the entire house. They've also seen an elderly woman walking around the house. She wears her hair in a bun and moves silently around the rooms. So which story do we believe? That the house is haunted or that it's not haunted? The current owners have said that they have been having issues with people trespassing on their property to see the house. So if you're listening, don't do that.
Yeah.
No going to these houses that are not ours.
Yeah.
So to this day, many people are unsure if the parents' experiences in the house were real or if they were fabricated. But Andrea, the eldest daughter, has written three books that document her experience in this house. The book is titled House of Darkness, House of Light, The True Story. And there are three mm-hmm. volumes, so three different books you can read. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But I, for one, will not be visiting this property.
Absolutely not.
And will probably be paying much more attention the next time I watch The Conjuring.
Yes. Wait, so you know how there were bodies in the walls in The Conjuring?
Were there? It's been such a long time.
I don't remember.
The last time I watched this movie was literally like when it came out in 2013. Because here's what happened.
Same year, actually.
Nora and I, when we decide on an episode, we have a Google Doc and we put in what we're going to cover. And I always put my thing in, but I was at work and I can't access the Google Doc. And I just had this feeling. I was like, oh my God, what if Nora and I do the same thing? So I get home and I'm like, let me look at the Google Doc. She had decided to do and already put in the thing what I was going to do. And I was like, damn it. So I changed to The Conjuring, but I didn't have enough time to watch the movie since I decided to cover it.
Yeah, no, that would be a lot.
So we'll have to watch the movie.
Yeah.
Because now that we know kind of more of what happened in the house, it would be kind of fun to watch the movie and see how it compares.
Yeah, and especially because, like, we haven't seen the movie in
years.
Almost 10 years.
Yes.
Like, that's crazy. We should watch it again, especially with spooky season coming up.
Oh, yes, spooky season. We're going to have movie nights.
Yeah.
But yeah, and some weird thing too, like I don't follow the Conjuring universe with all like the Annabelle movies and everything, but I've seen almost every single one of those movies somehow. It'll just be, we'll just watch it.
Same, because it's on like, you know, Netflix, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever it was on in 2013, like it's hard to avoid, you
and
know?
And it's, I mean, they're good spooky movies. Like if you want something scary, they're good movies.
They are scary. I get freaked out.
I do too. But yeah, so that's the Conjuring house.
Very cool. All right, so this week for Rhode Island, in the 1980s, or sorry, excuse me, I knew I was going to do this when I was reading through my notes. In the 1890s, tuberculosis, which was also called consumption at the time because it seemed to consume the person's body, was spreading like wildfire across the entire world. 1 in 7 people would end up dying from tuberculosis during this time period because there was no cure, no vaccination, nothing.
Vaccinations work, are you saying?
Is that what you got from that?
Wow. Interesting. Wow. All right. Keep going, Nora.
No wonder people don't get tuberculosis anymore.
That's crazy.
Tuberculosis was a devastating and much feared disease because not only was it super deadly, it was also super contagious. At the time, many people who were infected with tuberculosis would use a white handkerchief to cough, and you would know if someone had tuberculosis because they would cough up blood into their handkerchief, and you could actually see the blood spatter all over the white, like, color of it.
I don't like that.
In Exeter, Rhode Island, several members of George and Mary Brown's family suffered a sequence of tuberculosis infections in the final 2 decades of the 19th century. The mother, Mary, was the first to die of the disease, followed in 1886 by their eldest daughter, Mary Olive. Then in 1891, their daughter Mercy contracted the disease, and shortly after that, their son Edwin also contracted the disease. Mercy ended up dying a year later in 1892 from consumption or tuberculosis. The January temperatures were well below freezing, so Mercy was buried in a crypt, and the crypt was basically like a freezer, and it was above ground. And I think that the reason why she was put here was because the ground was too hard to dig into since
that
it was January.
Yeah.
So they basically stored her body in this crypt until they could properly bury her. Meanwhile, Edwin Brown was wasting away. According to history.com, for the better part of 2 years, he grew increasingly thin and weak. As tuberculosis ravaged the young man in March of 1892, Edwin struggled to breathe and he continually coughed up blood. He had sought a cure in the ratified air and mineral waters of Colorado Springs, Colorado, but the 18-month trip offered no healing powers and only left him homesick.
I've heard of that before. Like, during this time, people would travel to, like, Colorado or the places with a lot of just open space because it was said to cure tuberculosis.
The thing that's interesting, though, is, like, Colorado is in such high altitude that I feel like it would make it worse because it would be harder to breathe.
Yeah, make it harder to breathe or something.
Yeah, I mean, I get, like, the open air and fresh air and stuff, but that would be one issue. Edwin decided to return home to Exeter, Rhode Island, where his father, George, tilled soil as a Yankee farmer. George watched helplessly as the disease known as consumption took the lives of his wife, Mary, and their 2 daughters, Mary Olive and Mercy. It seemed his son, Edwin, held the same fate.
Aww.
I know. So I'm going to give some details on the background of tuberculosis and its history with vampires.
Okay.
So consumption, and I'll use those two terms interchangeably just so you know, but they're the same thing.
Yes.
Consumption was a poorly understood condition at the time and the subject of much superstition. It was believed that after the person who had been suffering from tuberculosis passed away, their body would be buried like normal. But soon enough, family members of the deceased person would begin to get sick and would start to lose their health. This was puzzling for people because the concept of contagion or being contagious didn't exist yet.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Isn't it? Ugh. So, I mean, people don't even know they need to cover their mouth. They need to keep distance. Like, that's crazy to me.
Covering their mouth and distance to stop something from spreading. That's weird.
Never heard of it before.
Sorry.
I know. It's like such simple things that people like fight to follow
right?
in some parts of the world.
Oh, man. Thus, some parts of the world.
Thus, a theory was created that the deceased person was actually still alive and was draining the life from the other people, mainly their family members. This theory was believed by people all over New England. Even people in Europe believed that this caused tuberculosis to spread. Because of this belief, it was also thought that those who had died, in quotes, would come out of their graves and attack their family members by sucking out their life.
So would they think that the person could just like come through the ground? Because wouldn't they check to see if the ground was disturbed?
But I don't think that those people were thinking about the logistics. I think they were just so desperate to find
a reason, that makes sense. Yeah.
Because there definitely wasn't disturbed ground or anything.
Yeah. Because you would think if someone's coming out of their grave, like where they were buried, that something would be disturbed.
Exactly. But people were so sure that these dead people who weren't really dead were coming out of their graves that they decided that the only way to protect the surviving family members from these vampires was to exhume and examine the bodies of those who died and had been buried. The person would indeed be considered a vampire and feeding on the living if their corpse seemed to be unusually fresh and hadn't decayed much. They would also be considered to be feeding on the living if their hearts and other organs still contained liquid blood.
How long does our body contain liquid? No, wait. We get embalmed. Just kidding. Right?
Embalmed? Human? Like when we die?
Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea.
It's called embalmed, right? I think so.
I think so.
And
but
I think that's
I
when
know.
They take all the liquid out of your body.
Sure. I have no idea.
I think. So I'm just going to go with this. So I think
that's
what happened.
That wasn't
so
happening,
back
though.
Then it wouldn't. So I'm wondering how long, like, your body would hold liquid blood.
Well, I think it's gonna talk about it later. But
you're gonna talk about it later.
Yeah, I'll talk about it later.
It's gonna talk about it later.
We'll get into that part.
Okay.
Okay, so they would also be considered to be feeding on the living if their hearts and other organs still contain liquid blood. If the body they exhumed had the characteristics of an undead or vampire, there would be several options. The first was very simple. Simply turn the corpse over in the grave.
Solid choice.
Yeah. The second way, which was used in more extreme cases, the body would be taken out of the grave and the organs would be removed. Those fresh organs would be burned and the body would be reburied. Sometimes this step may include decapitation.
Good.
It didn't say why.
Gotta cover all your bases.
Yeah, exactly. The third way is that in an attempt to cure the family members who were ill, they would inhale the smoke of the deceased person's burned organs, or they would consume the ashes of those organs. Sounds
contagious disease.
Really smart. I know, right? So smart. So they're literally inhaling the contagious person.
Oh
you
gosh.
Wrote that in your notes, which is so true. So as you can see, there were already multiple plans in place for what to do if someone was suspected to be a vampire. Friends and neighbors of the Brown family were convinced that one of the dead family members must have been a vampire, although at the time the term vampire didn't exist yet, so they didn't use that name. But they believed that what we now call a vampire had caused Edwin's illness. The townspeople believed that Edwin's mother and sisters may be undead or caught between heaven and hell and sucking the life out of him from beyond the grave. This was in accordance with threads of contemporary contemporary folklore, which linked multiple deaths in one family to undead activity, which, you know, it would spread across families,
mm-hmm.
so that's why they mm-hmm. thought that. At this point, Edwin was clinging to life, and the villagers wanted to make sense out of the tragedy and find someone to blame.
I get it.
I get it. They didn't know. Like, imagine how scary that would be.
Yes. And you were saying one in seven people. And then this family has, what, four? Three and fighting for the fourth.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, I mean, there are only two people left are Edwin and the dad. And now Edwin's on his way out. It's so sad.
The poor dad.
I know. So the father, George, who was one of the only last surviving family members, was persuaded to give permission to exhume several bodies from his family, like, of the people who died. Yeah. So the three girls, or I guess the two girls and the mom.
The mom, yeah.
George did not want to give permission to exhume the bodies and didn't believe in the vampire theory. He was way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
But he was ultimately convinced to give his blessing. Villagers, the local doctor, and a newspaper reporter, what a mix of people, exhumed the bodies on March 17, 1892. The bodies of both Mary and Mary Olive exhibited the expected level of decomposition, so they were thought to not be the cause of Edwin's illness. Mm-hmm. However, the corpse of the daughter Mercy exhibited almost no decomposition, and there was still blood in her heart and veins. Her cheeks were even still flushed. This was taken as a sign that the young woman was undead and was the cause of Edwin catching tuberculosis. The doctor who assisted in exhuming Mercy's body, Dr. Harold Metcalf, had raised his objection to the entire thing. He did not want the body to be exhumed, but he went ahead with it because everyone was freaking out.
Yeah, I feel like he doesn't really have much of a choice at that point.
Yeah.
Why does Metcalf sound so familiar?
It's a pretty common last name.
Oh.
I've met a few people with that last name.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
After her body was exhumed and everyone was in a panic, Dr. Metcalf assured everyone that the lack of decomposition of Mercy's body was perfectly consistent with the fact that she had been dead for less than 2 months. But that wasn't enough for the villagers. Knowing that medicine had done nothing to save the Browns, the people of Exeter ignored the doctor's proclamations and took the presence of fresh blood in Mercy's heart as a sign that she was definitely undead.
Have we evolved at all? From this time, not believing scientists.
I know,
not
right?
Believing doctors.
This poor doctor is like, you all are freaking crazy. I'm telling you, this is normal.
And if she's only been dead for 2 months, yes. And secondly, you said even that she couldn't be buried because it was too cold outside.
So her body was being preserved. Yeah, yeah, it was preserved. From there, the villagers gathered firewood and kindled a bonfire on a pile of nearby rocks. Then they cut out Mercy's heart and lungs and cremated them onto the pyre. They returned to Edwin's house with the ashes of his dead sister's heart and liver and mixed them with water. Edwin consumed the concoction, but unfortunately, it did not work. Surprise, surprise. Huh. The tuberculosis continued to consume him, and he died 2 months later on May 2nd, 1892.
Oh.
I know. Poor
That's
God.
Sad.
It's literally just the dad left.
Oh my gosh.
What remained of Mercy's body was buried in the cemetery of the Baptist Church in Exeter. In hindsight, her lack of decomposition, like I said, was due to being stored in freezer-like conditions for months.
Yeah.
So they just didn't want to hear that, though. The Mercy Brown vampire incident would be used repeatedly as inspiration in future novels. It is suggested by scholars that Bram Stoker, who's the author of Dracula, knew about the Mercy Brown case through newspaper articles and based the novel's character Lucy Westerna upon her.
Wow.
So that's probably the most well-known story that took inspiration for Mercy Brown.
Yeah.
But there are a ton of other ones that I came across that were less known.
Yeah. Like what?
So with that, which ones you said?
Yes.
I didn't write them down. I had never even like remotely heard of them. So I was like, I'm just going to mention
Dracula.
Oh, so
yeah, the lesser known ones, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. But with that, tuberculosis is no longer raging through the world, and that is due to vaccination.
Wow, good job. Good job, vaccinations.
Mm. All right, guys. Well, thank you so much for joining us this week. We hope you liked our haunted Rhode Island episode.
And you know what's so crazy about all vampire things? So you talked about a vampire. Mm-hmm. Another podcast I listened to did vampires. And then we just watched American Horror Story, mm-hmm. this new season, which is about vampires. And then one of my favorite shows, What We Do in the Shadows, is back on.
Ooh.
And it's about vampires. It's so freaking funny.
Ugh.
Please watch it.
Okay.
Like, if you have the humor of The Office,
I do.
You will fall into this humor. And it's like, it's a group of vampires who have a like TV crew following them, mm-hmm. and documenting their daily vampire lives.
Is it like a reality show?
It's like The Office. So, okay. You know, it's like, you know, this is their day-to-day lives as vampires.
That sounds so funny.
It's so funny. So Joe and I just finally watched like the next episode of the newest season. But yeah, so it's just like all the vampire things.
Very cool.
Oh, It's good. That's good stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I love that we covered these sorts of stories this week because it's very Halloween-esque.
I know.
And I love that for us.
I think this is our last episode in September before we enter into spooky season.
And boy, do we have some crazy stuff in store for you
all.
Oh,
yes, we do. Yeah. We're so excited for it.
Maybe.
Well, okay. Thank you for listening.
Thank you so much. And make sure to give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. We have mentioned before that we love when you guys leave us reviews, even if it's just to give us 5 stars. But when you drop us a few lines, that also is so exciting for
us. So exciting.
And I, like I said, we do read the reviews. So we decided that we're going to start shouting out the people who reviewed us.
Yeah.
So to start off, someone named Wink Obsessed, which, by the way, I think that's like the wine membership.
Oh,
which
it could be.
That W-I-N-C. Is so, I already like you so much because I use that website to order wine like I have before.
Really?
So yeah.
Oh.
So thank you so much, Wink Obsessed. And then we have another one from a Scary State fan.
And who are you? That's awesome.
I love it. It says that they look forward to hearing the Massachusetts episode. So I wonder if it's someone from Massachusetts.
I know Joe's excited about Massachusetts too.
And then finally, Jen Nurse 22 left us the sweetest review. And Jen Nurse 22, first of all, I'm pretty sure I know who you are because I saw that you liked someone named Jen just liked our Facebook group.
Oh.
Yeah, but I don't know. And then second of all, Jen, thank you so much for being a public servant as a nurse.
Yeah,
and, you know, through COVID, I'm sure you've been through a lot. So thank you. And thank you for your support, all of you.
So, yeah, thank you so much, everyone.
Like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, and give us a 5-star review. Thank you guys so much. We'll talk to you next time.
Stay scary.
Stay safe. Hey, everyone. Have you ever had the idea to start your own podcast but had no idea where to start? We had no idea either until we found Buzzsprout.
It is hands down the easiest and best way to launch, promote, and track your podcast. Buzzsprout has made our experience with podcasting both fun and stress-free by listing our show on all major podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Google Podcasts, just to name a few.
You'll get a great-looking podcast website, audio players that you can drop into other websites, detailed analytics to see how and where people are listening, tools to promote your episodes, and much more.
Following the link in the show notes, lets Buzzsprout know we sent you, gets you a $20 Amazon gift card if you sign up for a paid plan, and helps support our show.
Join over 100,000 podcasters already using Buzzsprout.
And remember to stay scary.
Stay safe.